Last time on Measured in Metric,
we talked about the Brooklyn Bridge, an engineering monument, and we talked about the people who built them and the people who use them. My name is Vivian Yu.
And my name is John Julius.
I'm a civil engineer.
And I'm married to a civil engineer.
Every episode, we normally pick one engineering monument and talk about how it was built and who built it and what it does.
And why it was built, how it was built, when it was built.
All the things.
We talk about so much, and then we always stumble on the introduction, but we really nail it in the actual discussion. This time, we did it a little bit differently. We did a two-parter. So basically, the Brooklyn Bridge turned into quite a big research project for Vivian. And we also had a really great opportunity to have an interview with an actual bridge engineer that Vivian works with. Kind of an interesting opportunity to split this off into two episodes.
So all that to say, this is part two of the Brooklyn Bridge episode.
Yes. Now, don't start with this episode. You want to go back and listen to episode one, because we're going to jump right into the middle. You're not going to have any idea what's going on unless you've previously researched the Brooklyn Bridge on your own, in which case, why are you listening to this?
Don't listen to him. You should listen to us anyway. So the Brooklyn Bridge, it's a bridge that connects Manhattan to Brooklyn. It was the first bridge to span the East River. And it was built in 1869 to 1883. We talked about all the people who had a hand in building it.
Yeah, some of them were pretty cool. Some of them were pretty crazy. Most of them were kind of both.
For the most part, yeah. It was mostly the Roebling family. And so we talked about John Roebling and we talked about Washington Roebling. And I feel like we maybe didn't talk about Emily Roebling as much as I would have liked. So I've got a little bit more here on her. But like I said before, she is basically the first female engineer that we are featuring on this podcast. And so I'm quite enthusiastic about that. She, at the time, of course, was not recognized as an engineer. She took over the project when her husband became paralyzed and could no longer be on site. He also became half blind and half deaf. This was all because of decompression sickness from working in the pressurized caissons. If you don't know what I'm talking about, like I said, go back.
Go back to episode one.
All right. So Emily Roebling, she took over the construction of the Brooklyn Bridge for the next 13 years. And there's a lot that have been said about Emily. We have her letters that she wrote to her sons. And I really like this passage that she wrote in her letter. She said, "I have more brains, common sense, and know-how generally than have any two engineers, civil or uncivil. And but for me, the Brooklyn Bridge would never have had the name Roebling in any way connected with it."
So a nice little bit of bravado.
Yeah, she's like, you know, sure, lots of civil engineers or whatever, but if it wasn't for me, that's never right. Would have been built.
I also like the subtext of, "My husband is a stubborn idiot whose sickness was completely preventable. Were he not just a stubborn man who insisted on working too hard?"
No, he didn't know. Back then, we didn't know how you got decompression sickness.
He went down and fought a fire underwater for like a full day, and then he came up. And so the East River is pretty deep. And then he came up and then he went down the next day, right? To keep on fighting the fire. And there was not just like, oh my goodness, it drives me nuts.
Yeah, he had symptoms after the first day and the doctor said, "Don't do it again." But he just had such a sense of responsibility, John.
I know. And his dad was also just like,
stubborn people.
Just so exasperating.
So let's go back to the woman and stop talking about her husband.
Okay. She's smarter.
Emily managed the construction officials and the contractors in terms of the technical details. She managed the board of directors and the mayor of New York over commercial management. She was the first woman to address the American Society of Civil Engineers, and she greatly impressed them with her technical knowledge. And she renewed their faith in her husband being the chief engineer, even though he was basically like incapacitated.
Right.
Emily was the first person to travel across the bridge once it was constructed. For some reason, she held a rooster in her lap. It was supposed to be good luck.
Okay. I kind of like that.
I guess. Yeah. Okay. Anyway.
I'm not going to read too much into it.
So like I said, before she finished the Brooklyn Bridge, she actually ended up going back home or to her husband's hometown in Trenton.
Right.
And building their family mansion. And she was the one who directed the contractors.
Oh.
And yeah, her nice. Own home. So in a way, the Brooklyn Bridge might have been the one that she's known for, but she definitely took that know-how and kept going with it.
Yeah, that's really cool.
And then she eventually got a law degree from NYU.
Also very cool.
Quite a woman. So that closes off the history. I really just wanted to add more to Emily.
Yeah, we did gloss over it a little bit.
Yeah. All right. So the science and innovations of the Brooklyn Bridge. We talked a little bit about the caissons. These were the upside down boxes that they used to dig underwater to get the foundations of the towers.
Yep.
They were huge, right? So they were used in Europe since 1831. But these caissons that were used for the Brooklyn Bridge would be larger than anything that they had ever built in Europe. And they would go 10 meters deeper than even anything that Brunel had done. So Brunel is a famous engineer in London at the time, kind of a contemporary of Bazalgette. We'll probably get to him at some point.
Yeah. Well, let's make that a promise.
Yeah.
Season 2, season 3, we'll get to him.
So these caissons were giant rectangular boxes. They were about 50 by 30 meters.
Okay.
As nice. Their base.
Yeah.
And they had about almost 3 meters of headroom. So higher than your home ceiling.
Okay. I like that.
It's really interesting. So you can think of this as like an upside down shoebox, but the sides were not just straight walls. They were V-shaped with the bottom coming to a point so that it was like a cutting edge into the riverbed.
Oh, cool.
It was built with a special type of wood because it had to be watertight.
Yeah.
And it had to be heavy enough that it could sink.
Oh, that's an interesting...
And they put rocks on top to help it sink, but basically it was going to be pressurized with water under it. Mm-hmm. So you couldn't have a light, soft wood. So they sourced a special type of wood that was so pitchy that it wouldn't even float if you made a raft from it.
Wow.
Do you know what pitchy means?
So when I think of pitchy, it's in reference to wood that's been burned. So what does pitchy mean on wood that has yet to be burned?
It's full of resin.
Yeah.
Yeah. A wood that should have a lot of resin in it that fills up all the air pockets.
Okay. Yeah. So that does make sense because then when you burn like a resinous wood, you wind up with pitch, which is like this distinct kind of ash.
Exactly.
Yeah. Okay.
So it's a yellow pine from Georgia and Florida. It's so full of resin that it seals the wood. And then it had multiple layers. So you would have a layer of timber with thick caulking and then a layer of tin and another layer of wood. And in the spaces in between, they filled it with hot pitch.
Nice.
So this thing was not just a wooden box. It was many layers, making it waterproof, sealed so that it can contain the pressure of the water from the outside and the air from the inside.
Yeah.
There was an airlock in a chamber that was connected to the surface so that people, the workers, could basically get in and out of the caissons without depressurizing it.
Yeah.
And you would have a pressurized air supply to maintain the pressure as well, because obviously a little bit of air is going to be released every time you open the airlock.
Right. And I was also going to ask about that too in regards to the fire.
Yes.
Yeah. You have a fire burning in a closed space.
Yeah. It's going to suck all the oxygen out. So
there you go. So you answered my question preemptively.
Well, and keep in mind that this box being 50 by 30 meters in size, it actually had rooms.
Right.
So it wasn't just a big room that people were digging in. It was sectioned off. And part of the reason for that is that originally John Roebling had designed it or wanted it to be just one big upside down box with no supports in the middle.
Yeah.
But to actually get this in place, they had to float it down like a boat.
Oh, geez.
And if you can imagine a giant, it would almost look like a cookie sheet, right? Think about how flat and wide it was.
Yeah.
Right? So you're trying to float this barge that's rectangular and has no aerodynamics around it or on it.
Yeah.
And you're trying to push it down this turbulent river. And if it didn't have cross beams basically across it at intervals, the thing would fall apart. It wouldn't structurally be able to go down the river and get pushed down into the riverbed.
Yeah, that makes sense. Because we have cookie sheets.
Yeah.
That can't even handle like the heat difference.
Yeah.
And they like bend and warp.
Exactly.
I hate those. We got to get new cookie sheets, by the way.
All right. Put that on the list.
But yeah, no, so that makes sense. I don't know if anybody has ever seen the East River, but like it's dirty and it's pretty fast.
It is very fast flowing. So basically, to make sure that this caisson could actually get down the river and in place without breaking apart, Washington Roebling had designed for crossbeams to be in there, built in, which made for tiny little rooms that were sectioned off.
Okay.
That people would then be working in. So I don't have a lot of details about the fire, but I would imagine it was contained in certain rooms and they were trying to prevent it from getting out.
Right. Okay. That makes sense.
There's also the question of how do you excavate and get the excavated earth out of that box, right? Because you can't just depressurize a hole and chuck it out.
Right.
So there would be this thing called the muck tube, and it's basically another tube to the surface. So you have one, which is the access chamber.
Okay.
That's for people.
Yeah.
You had another one, which would be the pressurized air supply.
Okay.
So that's another connection to the surface. And your third one would be the muck tube, which is a column that's filled with water. So it's actually water filled.
Yeah.
And yet the water doesn't fall in because you've got the air that's pressurized from below pushing it up.
Right.
It's like a reverse straw. Does that make sense?
It does not, because there have been so many times where people will like do some sort of a trick where they put something on and then they turn the glass upside down or something like that. And I know that it has to do with density, but you know how many glasses that I've tried to do this trick and I just be like, watch this. And then I flip it upside down and it just spills everywhere. So in my mind, I am having a hard time visualizing how that works. It's like, I believe that someone knows how to make it work. Not me.
Okay. So you've got this chamber that is filled with air and it's pressurized. Okay. So you then have a tube that reaches into that chamber.
Okay.
And if you leave it as air, then the chamber won't stay pressurized, right? Because the air will just escape back to the surface.
Yeah. So that's what I'm having issues with.
So rather than letting that tube be just air, you fill it with water. So all the way down to the bottom, this tube is filled with water. The water doesn't rush into the room because the air in the room is pressurized and pushing back up against the water.
Now, what is stopping the air from just put, because like, so water and air are both fluids.
Yeah.
So they will make space. And so I'm just thinking like, what's stopping the air from being pressurized and then just moving the water out of the way? The air rises up.
Like a bubble.
Yeah.
Like a bubble. I mean, it depends on the size of the tube.
Okay.
You know, when you pour like orange juice out of a jug too fast,
and it kind of gets that glug glug.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's because the hole is wide enough so that it can do that, right? And it's not equally pressurized between the air that's inside and the juice that's coming out. But whereas if you have this chamber that's pressurized to perfectly resist the amount of water,
right,
and the water pressure from externally, what's being exerted onto the caisson, you're going to be able to balance the two. Okay. Right.
Sure.
So the muck tube is a water-filled column that connects into the chamber.
Mm-hmm.
And you basically have a bucket.
Okay.
Tied to a rope, like a well.
Yeah.
So the bucket comes down, the workers fill it with the dirt that they've excavated, and then they pull it up the muck tube to take the dirt out of the chamber inside. and onto the surface level without depressurizing the chamber.
Okay. I like that.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't understand how the water part works, but I'm just going to accept that it's all right. So you get the right pressure, you get the right size tube, and you know.
Well, and it's the depth, right? Think about how much water that is. That is a heavy amount of water when you've got a tube that is that long.
Yeah.
Right? So the weight of the water is enough to resist against the pressure of the air.
Gotcha.
Okay.
I accept. I know that this is what engineers do. This is why we have engineers.
I'll post some pictures to show a diagram of how all this works.
Thank you.
Okay, the caissons. Once we've built the caissons, it built a very sturdy foundation because we keep digging at the riverbed until we reach bedrock, or at least a surface that is solid enough to build the foundations on. Mm-hmm. So then you get everyone out of there. You start filling that chamber that people were in with concrete so that it's no longer just pressurized air. It's now a stable surface. And then there's a platform on top of that box, basically, that you then build your actual towers on.
Okay.
The towers are pretty massive. They need to support the weight of the four huge suspension cables that are holding up the bridge, as well as the cable stays, so the diagonal cables that are connected to the bridge deck.
Yeah.
The thing is that these towers are quite high and the bridge deck is quite high because at the time they still wanted ships to be able to navigate under the bridge.
Yeah. They still want that, right? East River is still a shipping route. Yeah.
But both sides of Manhattan and Brooklyn are very low.
Right.
So you need to basically build a ramp or a viaduct.
Ooh.
So it's basically bridges from the ground level up to the bridge level.
Yeah.
On the banks of both sides.
Okay.
Okay. So your stone viaducts, and I'm kind of waiting for you to ask what a viaduct is, but.
Thank you for bringing that up because I was going to do a callback to our Los Angeles episode, but that's an aqueduct.
Yes.
So a viaduct is, so duct is like basically a tube, transportation tube, and via is Latin for by way of.
Via road, right? Via Appia was the Appian Way.
Yeah, it's by, a road. By way of road.
Yeah.
And this is by way of duct. So by way of tube. So yeah, what is a viaduct? How is it different from an aqueduct?
It's a road. It's transporting people, right? So via doesn't just mean by way of. Via also implies road. That's what the Roman.
Oh.
Via Appia, Appian Way. It's the Appian Highway.
Okay.
So a viaduct is a.
Oh man, I was way off.
Am I teaching you Latin?
I mean, linguistically, via does translate to by way of.
Yeah.
But yeah, so okay. Well, I thought that a viaduct was like an aqueduct, but it's so much different.
It's a linear way of transporting something.
Gotcha.
So a viaduct is different from a bridge in that rather than having just two sides of support with like a deck in between that spans between the two supports. Mm-hmm. That's typically a bridge. Yep. A viaduct usually has a lot of intermediate supports. So if you think of a bunch of arches that would support a road, that is what a viaduct is. In the LA Aqueduct episode, we posted some photos where it's like a pipe that's supported all along the way with these concrete structures.
Yeah.
A viaduct is similar.
Okay.
It's kind of like the Gardner is a viaduct because it's an elevated highway and it's not a bridge, right? Because it's not bridging over anything other than just land.
Yeah.
But it's elevated from the land.
Okay, cool. And also for those of you that don't live in Toronto, the Gardner is a terrible highway. It's not the worst highway, but it's not a good highway. It's a lot of traffic. It kind of cuts through downtown. There's one part of it as you're coming in from the east and then you drive in and it's nice. There's like the buildings kind of up all around you and it's pretty dramatic. Other than that, it's not a great highway.
We've got some road problems in Toronto. Let's not get into that.
Yeah. Let's keep on moving.
All right. That's the towers. That's the foundation. The bridge deck is I mean, there's not a lot to say about it other than it was actually designed not to be perfectly horizontal.
Okay. Why was that?
It bows gently upward. Part of that is so that it could give enough clearance right in the middle of the span for the ships to get underneath.
Yeah.
Partly is because it gives it a little bit of room in case any of the cables do snap. Remember, John Roebling originally said, even if the suspension cables snap, it won't fall.
Yes.
A factor of safety there. It also just looks nice to have this bridge that arches slightly up and over rather than being perfectly horizontal.
I kind of get that. There's a bridge in Kelowna, British Columbia.
Mm-hmm.
And so linking between Kelowna and West Kelowna, which used to be an independent, but you're, so you're driving kind of over the Okanagan, and it's a very steep bridge. It used to be a drawbridge kind of a thing that would come up in the middle to let boats pass. Then they rebuilt it and it's very steep. It's very dramatic driving across it. So I am on board with like bowed bridges.
Yeah. Well, this one is not so dramatic. It's just slight, but you can definitely see it from a distance.
Yeah.
In terms of the support system of the actual bridge, so we talked about the suspension part.
Okay.
The diagonal stays. So that's the triangular cables that connects the towers directly to the bridge deck. There's also the stiffening truss. So the truss is basically a system of triangles that are connected to build a stronger bridge deck structure. And you'll see trusses in most warehouse buildings, right? If you look up towards the ceiling, the trusses are usually what's holding up the ceiling.
Yeah.
So it's the triangles.
Yeah.
And basically John Roebling designed this bridge to use all three elements to get it enough stiffness to resist the wind loads.
Okay.
And to also span the entire East River when people said that it wouldn't be possible.
Yeah.
So with these three systems, he was able to build in numerous redundancies in his design. And in case of emergency, even if all the suspension cables fail, the bridge would not fall. It may not be operational, but it would not fall. And I think that's really nice because we've talked about this in the interview with Chris Mealing, where he talked about, you know, worst case scenario.
Yeah.
The Brooklyn Bridge was built to be six times as strong as it needed to be.
Okay. Now, do you know if six times as strong as it needed to be is like a common measure, or is that?
The factor of safety for bridges, I can't pretend to know what it is because I'm not a bridge engineer.
That's fine.
But I think given the time that it was designed in and the time that his contemporaries would have included as a factor of safety, I think it's well above and beyond what was normal in the 1800s. So now I've said before, the cables are built with steel ropes instead of iron. The steel strands are basically woven together like you would weaving yarn together.
Yep.
And each strand is about as thick as a pencil.
Oh, really?
And then there would be 1,000 strands to make a cable.
Oh, gotcha. Okay, good. I was going to be like, whoa. So it's 1,000 pencils twisted together.
Yeah.
Gotcha.
Each cable itself was just under 40 centimeters in diameter.
Yeah. Okay. So for those of you that don't regularly measure in metric, 30 centimeters is 1 foot.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So it's more than a foot.
Yeah.
It's pretty crazy. This is the first time using steel wires instead of iron wires. Now, should we maybe get into a little bit of what makes steel different from iron?
Well, so steel is an alloy.
Correct.
Right? And so it's iron and tin?
Close. Iron and carbon.
Iron and carbon. Okay.
Right. So when you think of medieval times with like the blacksmith like hammering the sword.
Yeah.
Part of that is to get the carbon from the fire and the ashes to be hammered into the iron to make it steel, to make it stronger.
Gotcha.
Okay. Steel is iron plus carbon. It makes it a stronger, more durable, more resistant to rust, easier to work with, and a cheaper material than pure iron.
Yeah. There you go. Because carbon is everywhere. I don't know if you guys know this, but we've got carbon in the air that we got to get rid of. So, yeah.
That's right.
Yeah.
All right. So that's basically the science and innovations of this. I think it's worth mentioning that it was quite a success as well because they actually did legitimate geotechnical surveys.
Ooh. I don't know if you know this, but geotechnical surveys is like basically the sexy underbelly of engineering.
Is that what you've learned this season?
Yeah. Just like watching Vivian's face light up. There's something erotic about geotechnical surveys when they're done properly.
I sucked at geotech. So like, I don't get it.
Sure.
But I really, truly appreciate someone else feeding me that information when I need it, because certainly you need it. Yeah. For any project, yeah. Any civil engineering project, do proper geotech.
Yes. Also, Vivian hates bureaucracy. So it's not just like bureaucratic nonsense. I know that because Vivian likes geotech and hates layers of approval. So there's something good about geotech.
It's not just red tape, okay? It's there for a reason.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Let's get the unpleasant stuff over with. 20 people died in the construction of the Brooklyn Bridge.
Yikes.
Over hundreds suffered from the bends or decompression sickness.
Not good.
So that was during construction. Within a week after the bridge opened, there was also another pretty big issue, not because of the bridge itself, but a woman tripped on the bridge and screamed.
Okay.
And other pedestrians thought she was screaming because the bridge was falling and a stampede occurred on the bridge.
Oh, dear.
So within minutes, 12 people had been trampled to death. And right. 35 more were wounded.
Oh, man.
Those were the first post-construction casualties of the bridge.
That's not great.
I will say that there are a lot of rehabilitation projects planned for the bridge. There's a lot of money being spent to restore it. And I know I talked about the level of safety and how safe it is and how many redundancies there were. So it might seem a little counterintuitive that we are actually putting so much money in keeping it from falling apart. Let's keep in mind that it was built 150 years ago.
Yeah.
Anything 150 years out in the elements are going to need repairs. There's also an issue that right after World War II, there were just not that many maintenance workers rehabilitating and maintaining the bridge itself. And so during the 70s, it really deteriorated. Oh. There was just not very much work being done to it, especially at that 100-year mark. That's a very crucial time for bridges to get a little bit of love.
Yeah. And also, I mean, I've never lived in New York, but from the media, New York in the 70s was kind of a... It was New York in the 70s. Like, there was some glamour to it, but it was not a glamorous place.
I don't know what that means, but okay.
Just watch The Warriors.
We also should keep in mind that since the 1880s, when the bridge was built, we've gotten a lot bigger vehicles. We've gotten a lot of different types of things that we're transporting across the bridge.
Yeah.
It was originally built for wagons and trolleys.
Mm-hmm.
For a while, it was carrying trains across. It no longer is.
Right.
But there's still heavy vehicles. There's a lot of different vibrations that are caused by buses, by cars. And actually, since the 70s, vans, trucks, and buses are no longer allowed to drive over the bridge. So it's only small vehicles, people, and cyclists.
Interesting.
Something that was also unfortunate was that during the construction of the bridge, some of the cables that John Roebling had specified, were replaced by a cheaper counterfeit cable by one of the contractors that was trying to make a little bit of money, cut some corners. And so they had discovered this, but not in time to replace all those cables.
Yeah.
So they added additional cables to support those cheaper ones, but now in the mid-80s, it actually started catching up to them and those cheaper cables started snapping.
Yikes. So for an idea of mid-80s New York, check out the film Escape from New York starring Kurt Russell. You can probably see those garbage cables. That's a rough movie too.
All right. Look out for garbage cables in that movie then.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. So all that said, anything that lasts that long is going to need rehabilitation, especially with the advance of new technology, especially with the advance of different use right? How we intend to be using the bridge has changed. And it's also necessary to keep up with the times if we do want additional cycle lanes, if we want additional capacity for transit. There are just things that you need to do to your infrastructure and your aging infrastructure to make it work and continue working for the future. And I think, you know, the maintenance of our infrastructure in North America especially is something that is often overlooked, but very necessary.
Yeah.
Anyway, Brooklyn Bridge, really quite the engineering marvel. I think it's really a success story of the innovations that can come together and build such an amazing monument.
Yeah. I also like that the Brooklyn Bridge, it still looks cool. There's still kind of this aura about it where you look at it and you're like, that is the Brooklyn Bridge. I don't know. I really, really like New York City. So.
And that's all from us.
That's right. So now coming up, we have an exclusive interview
with Chris Mealing, who is the unit director for Canada for the business that I work for, Mott MacDonald. He is a bridge engineer by background, and it was so amazing to be able to sit down with him to talk about bridge engineering practices in general. I think you guys are going to learn a whole lot from him. I certainly did. And yeah, I hope you enjoy. Right. So really excited here today at Measure to Metric. We've got our first interview. So I've got Chris Mealing with me. I'll let him tell you about his background, but he is basically the unit manager, general manager for Canada for our business, Mott MacDonald. So Chris, why don't you tell us a little bit about yourself?
Okay. I'm super glad to be here today. I was intimidated before we started, but now that I'm your first interview, the pressure has mounted considerably. So as you said, my name is Chris Mealing. I'm the unit managing director for the Canada unit of Mott MacDonald. So I have overall operational responsibility for our services in Canada. I began my career as a bridge engineer and spent most of the first half of my career as essentially a bridge construction engineer, working for and around and in support of contractors. Moved on to sort of design build management, sort of combining my enjoyment of doing engineering and actually building work. And the last 5 or 6 years, as many of us do, I've sort of evolved into a role more responsible for the operations of the company as opposed to actually getting to do real work.
Yeah, that's a very humble way of saying it. But from what I can tell about Chris is that he's still very involved in the technical side of the business, which I personally really appreciate. Can you tell us a little bit what led you to structural and bridge engineering in general? And how do you sleep at night?
It's a funny story. I actually started in chemical engineering, but turned out to be the wrong thing for me. Actually, I grew up in and around Toronto. And when I was starting university in the late 80s, there were places like what was called BCE Place at the time downtown, and the foyer of the Scotia Building.
Right. Really iconic places.
Like there's really iconic places. And I thought, well, you know, I'm not an architect. So we had a conversation the other day about drawing things and having, but I really thought somebody dreamed up the shape of this thing, but somebody had to figure out how did they figure out how to make it work? And that led me to really wanting to be a structural engineer. And of course, I think like many structural engineers, I wanted to get into designing soaring, interesting things, which I suppose I still would have liked to have gotten into. Then I found as I went through my university career and did co-op terms, and as I initially got out of school, I realized the kind of workmanlike nature of things. Playing with lumber and hammering things together and digging holes and pouring concrete and the activities of construction I also found fascinating.
Yeah.
And then through the usual kind of flukes you have in your career, I found myself a year after I graduated, got an opportunity to work for a really strong construction engineer who spent a lot of time helping contractors figure out how to actually build stuff.
Okay.
Which ended up being a great combination of both really tricky structural problems. How do I make this strong enough to survive the work it's doing? Can we actually pick this up without breaking it? How would you move this around? Mixed with the really cool visceral thing of like picking heavy things up with cranes and banging big piles into the ground and digging big deep holes. And so there, that sense of being on site with big equipment doing work. And I think that combination of having a really solving really technically tricky problems while getting to play with really big toys, or at least watch people play with really big toys.
It's very tangible, right?
Yeah, very tangible sort of sense of it. We used to get paid to do a lot of value engineering. The designer will have designed the bridge to be constructed a certain way, and the contractor client would want to go, well, we want to build it from the other end back. And so quite often we'd get into these really intricate problems of redesigning the structure such that it could meet the contractor's approach to how they wanted to build it. Would it be possible to build this post-tensioning bridge from this end to that end, rather from that end to this end, which required, you know, proving it could be done and then reanalyzing all the analysis. So it was this really neat combination of the technical challenges at the pointy end of some really interesting analysis.
Yeah.
With the, again, the sort of the visceral thing of actually getting to hang around with the people who did the work.
Yeah, definitely. I think that's one of the best parts about civil engineering in general is the applied science side of it, right?
Yeah.
Can you share a little bit about a project you've worked on, something that you're really excited about or really proud of?
Probably my largest professional accomplishment is I was the design manager for about $1.6 billion of the onshore works on the Portman Highway 1 bridge. So, of course, the Portman reconstruction in the sort of 2008 to 2012 was very much about the new iconic structure across the Fraser River. But the project consisted of 36 kilometers of highway and bridge construction. You know, we would say that the billion-dollar bridge in the middle was the easy part, and the $1.6 billion that was spent upgrading the 13 interchanges up and down the highway was actually really, really tricky. But the job I actually am most proud of is probably a little after I started with Mott MacDonald in Vancouver. I led a design build of a 12-span municipal bridge, highway bridge in the center of Langley, which is called the 204 Street Bridge. If you live in Langley, you'll drive over it. And if you don't, you'll never see it. Really, it was a neat, twisty bridge across a highway and a railway. It was in a sort of a serpentine shape.
Oh, wow.
Done as design build, $35 million in 2006. So, you know, not a small project, but not a big project by modern scale.
Sure.
But we went from notice to proceed to open to traffic in 18 months.
Wow.
With a small team. We did most of the design with a team of about 8 people. We were driving 60 meter piles 8 weeks after we got notice to proceed. It was doing our test pile program. We did some really neat seismic analysis. So I got to work with a great team of people, but a small core team, a really intimate relationship with the contractor. A really tricky bridge. It's never going to make anybody's bridge calendar, you know, hanging on the wall, but it's actually a tricky thing when you go look at it. And it was a really, 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 like, you know, Wendy and Mark and Peter and Philippe and I drew every bar, moved everything, invented the thing, checked each other's analysis. It was really great. It was the best of design build to actually get to do a really tricky thing. And then go hang around as it all got built and then do it all in a real, real hurry. It was awesome.
It's engineering in a really pure sense of the word, hey?
For me, yeah. It combined all of the best bits of design and build.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, I mean, just a little bit of context for our listeners that are more lay people and not engineers. Bridges, and you can correct me, please, if I'm wrong, but bridges tend to be a lot more complicated the moment you add different modes like railway and different modes that it would have to serve. And especially if it's not a straightforward bridge, you know, if you're talking about curves and serpentining around different obstacles, it definitely gets a lot more complicated because your loads have to be calculated in different geometries and whatnot.
True. I think one of the things that's happened, of course, over the last, so I mean, I graduated in 93. So I would say over the 25 years, our analytical capabilities and our modeling capabilities are profoundly more capable today than they were then. I mean, we were doing finite element analysis then. So we all heard the stories when we were growing up of our profs telling us about the stack of punch cards. We just have to wait by the computer and blah, blah, blah. Now, it wasn't that, but it was probably analogous to that. We would try to do a shell analysis of a deck, you know, a finite shell analysis of a deck, but you'd program the text file, which you imported into the thing, and you'd turn it on at the end of the day and come back in the morning to run the analysis, and then you'd download it. And then It was a whole separate exercise to get a graphical representation of that, et cetera. So compared to the kind of stuff that just desktop deployable for our young engineers today. So I'd say things like curved bridges, some of the intricate cable stays, a lot of the intricate geometry you'd see today. And with parametric design, the kinds of things we're seeing people do in Rhino or in is a Dynamo inside Autodesk and that kind of parametric design, which has become so a generative design that we're seeing now, that ability that you can draw very complex geometry and allow the computer to automatically translate that into the analytical models, that would have been a material, what today you can wire some components to do, would have been a significant portion of the, we have to keep the geometry simple enough that I can
still compute
that I can compute what the geometry is so I can import it into the model, where today we can draw much more organic shapes and let the computer translate that into the analytical models. I think that we look back and we see some really of the traditional arch forms because like literally humans had to somehow work out where the coordinates of all those bits were, and that to a point limited. And that's why I think for me, you see some of the really elegant bridges that were designed in the, well, whether it's the Lionsgate in the 20s or the bridges we see in Europe that were designed in the 50s and 60s. And what's really striking about them is the fact that they were able to do these elegant forms and come up with analytical means to analyze them. And the fact that the engineering, the math behind that was really elegant in order to be able to do something that cool looking and still be able to analyze it in an effective way.
Yeah.
We can brute force stuff today that would have had to have been done elegantly 30 years ago or 40 years ago, if that makes sense.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, a little bit of context. This interview is going with the Brooklyn Bridge episode, which that was built far before we had any type of computational analysis.
Right.
And there was a lot of redundancies, right? These shapes was not as elegant, perhaps. And
I think in a lot of it is they were probably, I think elegant is not a bad word, because the Brooklyn Bridge is, it's that form follows function. You can trace the lines of force. So lay people can see the lines of action of the Brooklyn Bridge or the Lionsgate Bridge. And I mean, it's trickier than it looks, and they've stood up to the test of time and changing loads, so which should give us pause at how strong the engineering was. But I think the fact that they come out as such elegant structures is because the lines of force had to be traceable so that the analytic capabilities could find out, which just doesn't take anything away from the just the capacity those people had to be able to visualize and then do that. I think today for me, again, having grown up in Ontario where seismic design is not the most significant driver in design, and moving to British Columbia where I've spent the last half of my career where seismic design is often the primary driving thing, I've said that has probably been the most complicated thing for me, because the seismic drivers are often quite completely distinct from the gravity loads that the bridge is being designed for. The effects of geometry on seismic performance are often quite different than the effects of the geometry on the base alignment of the structure. The performance criteria we're designing the bridge for, whether it's repairable in a certain earthquake or it's designed for life safety or it's elastic in a certain earthquake, is again, often drives compromises which are quite distinct from your what you would have done if you were analyzing only gravity loads.
Oh, that's really interesting.
So getting a bridge which is constructible, which has adequate detailing, which survives large horizontal ground movements in any direction, plus shaking, plus perhaps subsidence of the ground, is obviously quite a different set of constraints on the design than would have been there just like to simply hold up the bikes, the cars, and the train that had to get from over here to over there.
Yeah, for sure. I think one thing you said there that was really interesting to me was whether it was repairable under seismic activity. So are you designing it for it to fail a certain way if it does have to fail so that it could be...
So my seismic peers should cover their ears as I butcher the answer to your question here. But I'd say as the industry has evolved, our ability to describe, and as we think of different categories of earthquakes, what we're looking increasingly to do is to say, we need to think about bridges performing to different standards depending on how severe the earthquake is. Mm-hmm. So typically there will be a standard which says we should be able to take an earthquake of this size and not notice. Essentially, everybody should be able to get up in the morning and drive across the bridge as if nothing happened. So essentially elastic behavior. And that might be at a number like a 1 in 100 earthquake or a 1 in 475 earthquake.
Okay.
The other end of the scale, we will typically have a life safety earthquake, say at a 2,500 year earthquake, 2475, which is it needs to not fall down and kill anybody.
Okay.
In this really, really, like at this earthquake, we can't have it fall down and kill anybody. We'll agree that it's a wreck. We probably have to demolish it. We've exceeded limit states in many cases, but it's exceeded limit states without collapsing. So okay. There's quite often a no collapse criteria at a very high level of earthquake. Okay, so that means that we can get a really, really big earthquake and at least it's not going to land on the street below. And that's, you know, the effects of the Northridge earthquake in LA. And they had a number of those bridges, the spans collapsed and crushed the cars below. And so a bunch of people said, okay, like in a really big earthquake, we can't have that happen. The thing might have to get demolished when we're all done, but it can't be crushing cars in the middle of the earthquake. What we then found, of course, is somewhere in between there, we want a middle performance thing where we're prepared to close the bridge and spend a bunch of money having to fix it, but it would be nice if we didn't have to throw it out. What that means in practice is often a really tricky part of the analysis and the discussion with the owner or trying to understand what the owner wants, because it's a relatively easy concept to say aloud. It becomes quite a hard concept to put numbers to. Well, how much money are you willing to spend to repair it? Does that mean you're willing to put shoring underneath it while you fix it? Or do you mean I need to be able to repair it while ambulances are still driving over it? And so how do you quantify repairableness?
Okay.
So really, really tricky. So, you know, my learned colleagues are cringing, but I think a really interesting middle ground between those two ideas of essentially keeping all the stresses down to elastic levels, in which case it's just another load case, as opposed to, okay, we can't have the bars strain more than this and snap. The one in between, which is they strained a lot, but are they still good?
Right.
Is where a lot of the really tricky cases often are.
That's definitely really interesting. Okay, maybe spinning it back a little bit. What goes into deciding the type of bridge that you design for a situation?
There are easy end cases on both sides. In many cases, owners have a utilitarian problem they need to solve for the minimum amount of capital expenditure. Literally just need to fix this traffic problem. I need to get here. Mm-hmm. I don't have any money. So what's essentially the most reasonable way to get four lanes of traffic from over here to over there? How to take what's two lanes now and make it wider? I have a bridge in place. It needs to be bigger and it's falling down. I don't actually have any money in the capital budget. So quite often you've got an economy driver at one end of the scale. And that, you know, that's a significant portion of our infrastructure exists to serve a narrow practical purpose.
Yeah.
At the other end, lots of owners want iconic structures. They want to create a sense of place. They want to establish a signature bridge. They want to have an aesthetic accomplishment. And that will drive, well, we want a big soaring cable stay because cable stays look cool and it would put our town on the map.
Yeah.
We want a pedestrian bridge to create an iconic place. We want a sweepy pedestrian bridge with a cool arch because it'll make this a destination for the public. And so those are pretty easy to understand. And then, of course, in the real world, we quite often end up somewhere between there, which is I only have this much money. I need to solve a practical problem. Wouldn't be nice if
it also looked good.
If it could also look good. And so in many of our day jobs, the kind of art of what we get to do is how nice a thing can we make realistically for the budget that an owner can afford.
Right. Okay.
And I think that's probably true. That's true in building design. It's true in architecture. It's true. Everybody wants the soaring atrium. Not many people can afford the soaring atrium. How can I have a thing that kind of feels like a soaring atrium for the $50 I actually can afford to pay?
Yeah, for sure. We've talked about seismic activity and how that affects bridge design. How have you seen climate change affect the way you design bridges?
So I'd say in North America, probably not a great level of expertise for me, but I would say we're still in the early stages of quantifying, like from a quantifiable design code basis.
Right.
Starting to see that effect. So typically bridge codes, like many other codes, have climatic conditions we have to drive for: design winds, design storms, design rainfall, design earthquakes. And those are in codes. And I would say many of those codes are beginning to catch up and ask themselves whether, you know, in Toronto, for example, an awful lot of our storm design, a lot of our has been Hurricane Hazel. yeah, which was the 100-year storm is Hurricane Hazel from the late 50s or whenever it was. And of course, we're now looking and saying, okay, the Hurricane Hazel 100-year storm is no longer the reasonable standard in the current world. So I think codes are catching up to that. In Vancouver, we're seeing a lot more explicit consideration of sea level rise and early guide codes from the various organizations starting to drive that. But I think we're still in the awkward teen years of that conversation, where the awareness that we have to be more conscious of climate change and tangibly considering it in our design, I think that awareness is now there. The quantification of the this number, not that number,
right,
I think is still an evolving conversation.
I mean, our infrastructure is built for 50-year lifespans typically. And so,
yeah, 75 is a pretty typical thing for bridges.
So you kind of do have to factor in that future proofing and figuring out what that forecast might look like without, like you said, a tangible number to rely on.
Well, and I think people's, for example, sea level rise is a big discussion in Vancouver. So people are recognizing that, well, we can't design for higher high water off the chart, because sea level rise is tangible. And in the next 100 years of the life of the structure, it could be that sea level goes up a meter or 2 meters, 3 meters. But then the question gets to be, well, is it 1 meter or is it 2 meters or is it 3 meters? Because 1 meter costs this much more and 2 meters cost that much more. And I think, you know, climate change, we have a great M&E team here. I think it's a really interesting conversation for our mechanical electrical team. Is temperature changes, temperature variation starting to be considered in building design? Not my area of expertise, but I expect so.
Yeah.
The other thing is this concept of resilience. The other place we're seeing a change is this idea of resilient infrastructure. The idea that, putting aside the why of climate change, acknowledging that it's becoming increasingly less acceptable to sustain the level of damage that has occurred when we get a major storm event, when we get a major climate event, and everything floods. What's the cost to put it back in service? How quickly can it be put back in service? I think those ideas of resilience are really strong in the industry today and are moved along quite a long way.
Yeah, definitely. Calgary had a major flood several years back, and we definitely saw the rise of this resiliency program trying to reinforce some of our embankments and our bridges,
right,
in particular to
and flood management there. And Winnipeg, and actually Toronto, we had a major flood of 4 or 5 years ago in Toronto that, you know, flooded a bunch of the underpasses and GO trains were stuck. I was living in an apartment at Clarkson and that was 2013, I guess. And there was a day-long blackout that came in. So the idea of some of those events have started to bring home that, you know, these major storm events are not in foreign countries and tropical islands, that this is happening in major Canadian cities and we're not really ready for it. Or the infrastructure that was built in the 50s, the power system that was built in the 60s is not really robust enough to respond to some of these events these days.
Yeah, definitely. Okay. Well, we'll get to our last question here. What is your favorite bridge?
Wow. Lots of iconic bridge. There's a bridge in England called the Gateshead Millennium Bridge.
Okay.
And it's a horizontal arch. So an arch in plan that people walk along, and it's an arch in vertical arch, which is the structural member. And it rolls like an eyelid. It allows ships to pass, or I guess small boats to pass. And it accomplishes that by essentially rolling like an eyelid.
Yeah.
And then there's lots of versions of bridges like that, but it was built around 2000, around the same time as the Millennium Bridge at the Tate Modern, which first got all the press because it's awesome.
Yeah.
And it had the vibration problems, which is an awesome. So there's so many iconic, particularly pedestrian bridges these days, where have the gravity loads are low enough and the geometry is such that you can do some really interesting things. But probably the one that struck me, I look at a bridge and I go, is that ever clever? Is that ever clever? And is it ever an interesting pattern of how it has to respond as it does different things? So my quick answer would probably be that.
Yeah, that's a really good answer. I know which bridge you're talking about. It is very cool. Thank you so much. That's all I have prepared, but I think we've had some really great discussions. Thank you so much for agreeing to do this interview.
That's great. Thanks for having me. And if I can come back someday and chat again, that would be awesome.
Yeah, thanks.
Thank you.
That that is our full season. Thank you so much for sticking with us.
I know that it's been a real slog because we're not pleasant people, but thank you so much for your patience. Greatly appreciate everything that you are.
Your support and the fact that you guys listen to us every 2 weeks. I've gotten such great feedback. We're so excited about the traction that we've gotten in the first season. And we are planning our second season. Like we said before, we're taking a little bit of a hiatus. John and I will be in Australia for a little while.
But we'll be there learning about all sorts of other engineering things.
That's right.
Because I don't know if you know this, but they do have engineers in Australia. That's why we're going.
Apparently not enough.
Yeah, but we're going because they don't have enough engineers in Australia. But Vivian's a particularly good engineer. So anyhow.
Oh, so please stay in touch. And if you haven't listened to our previous episodes, if you're just a new subscriber, now is a great time to get caught up in all our episodes from season one.
Yep.
And reach out to us on social media and let us know what you would like to hear about in season two.
Also, if you're considering starting your own podcast, if you've listened to us and said, oh, if these guys can do it, anyone can do it, look at Astronomic Audio because they have been a tremendous help to us throughout this entire season. They've not only given us audio editing services, but they've also given us tons of advice on how to expand our reach, on best practices, all sorts of stuff. A true, true fantastic resource. So Astronomic Audio.
Definitely.
We owe tremendous gratitude. A million thanks.
All right. So we are on social media, on Facebook and on Instagram at Measured and Metric. We're at Measured and Met on Twitter. And of course, our website is measuredandmetric.com. We will see you again in a couple of months with season two. But in the meantime, do remember, measure and metric.
If it's your birthday, happy birthday.